Blog Talk Radio.
Hello.
Wyatt?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi, this is Leslie Gist. Hello, audience. You listen to the Gist of Freedom? We are sorry for the delay, but it's definitely worth it because we have Swan Gallery's experts in African American manuscripts and collections. This is Mr. Wyatt Houston Day on the line. How are you, Mr. Day?
I'm good. How is everybody?
Oh, I'm doing well. Could you just start off the show by explaining who you are and how you got involved?
Okay. My name is Wyatt Houston Day, and about 17 years ago or so, I had an idea about to create an auction of African-American material, and that means serious African-American material, not... not what a lot of people consider African-American material, which is what's so-called black memorabilia. And I thought that there was a great need to have some kind of a venue that would coax material out into the open, where people would get stuff out of their attics and dresser drawers and closets and so forth that perhaps they'd forgotten about, Auntie Jane's letters or something like that. And so the first sale, I shopped this sale to a couple of galleries, and the first one that the people that went for it was Swan, thank God, and thanks Swan. And 1995, I put it all together, and we had the first sale in 1996. And The depth and breadth of this sale covers everything from the 16th century to the present. That is, in short, or in long, wide, and deep, the African-American experience, period, from the beginning, and that is in both Americas, in South and Central America, as well as in North America.
Now, can we slow down just a little bit, Wyatt? First of all, let us tell the audience that you are not African American.
No,
I am
not.
And I know that many people are wondering, why on earth would you be so serious and adamant about preserving African American history?
Well, there are a number of reasons, but I might ask back. Why does an Irishman become an expert on Egyptian antiquities? Because it interests that person. But to go a little further into my own history, I've had a kind of love affair with Africa since I was about 10 years old. And it is always, the entire continent has always been a place that fascinated me, and that I always felt that there was something, there was a great deal about Africa, especially sub-Saharan Africa, a great deal that we didn't know. I mean, what happened to millions and millions of people that were taken out of sub-Saharan Africa and deposited into the West Indies and South and Central America and North America? And I do have family members who are black, by the way, including my wife and children, but also my cousin, and I mean, we are a mixed family. But actually, I've been asking people, say, oh, well, that's the reason you went into it. But I went into this area long before I married my wife, and it was because there really is a need. It's an area of study, of history, and I'm a history fanatic. I'm a consummate history fanatic. And
what was your
area.
First piece that you? What was your first piece that you collected? Do you remember?
That's interesting. I have a huge. I should preface this. I have an enormous collection of black poets, and it begins with first edition of Phyllis Wheatley's poems. It goes right through a great deal of Langston Hughes, including quite a few original poems inscribed and signed by Langston. But the very first thing that I ever bought It was when I was in college, and I used to live, I lived on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and I used to come downtown, and I'd walk across 8th Street, and there used to be a bookshop on the corner of 8th Street and McDougal Street on the corner called the 8th Street Bookshop. And I always loved books. My father had a big library, and I started reading very young, and just books are something I love. So I would always pause in front of this bookshop and take a look in the window and go inside. I didn't have much money while I was in school, but I bought books here and there. And so I went. They had a book in the window by Leroy Jones, who is now called Amiri Baraka, and it was called Prelude to a 20-Volume Suicide Note. And I said, I've got to see this. So I went inside, and I bought it. And I loved it. It was really, really grabbed me. There was a lot of more than just plain poetry and love and flowers and all that. It was really solid, wonderful stuff. And that was the first piece. And I kept over the years buying books of poetry by African Americans here and there. And by the way, I love poetry anyway. I read Walt Whitman and other poets too. too. But I started collecting, and the core of my library, which is nearly 3,000 volumes in my house, the core of my library is an enormous collection of over 600 volumes of African-American poets, many of whom were published in the early part of the 20th century, in the latter part of the 19th century, very often just by the church, the AME or the Baptist Church. So that is really how I got started. I was with Amiri Baraka, Leroy Jones' first book. But
did you ever have the opportunity to meet any of these people that you?
Oh, I know Amiri is a dear friend of mine. I matter of fact, I praised his entire papers, all of his writings and manuscripts, and. I've met, oh my Lord, I'm over the years, it's been getting close to 30 years that I've been doing this, but 25 years solid that I've had my own business, and I've met many, many, many people through just being in the world that I'm in, and that world being of the world of rare books and manuscripts, and also... because of the Swan sale, you know, it's been 17 years doing that, and the sale is very well attended by many, many, many people in the black community and the academic community. And that's how I met Henry Louis Gates, who's a very close friend of mine, too, through this
sale. And for our listeners who may not remember... Henry Louis Gates was involved in the incident.
Well, Henry Louis Gates is the head of the Du Bois Institute at Harvard, the Black Studies Department at Harvard. And he's the author of a number of books. And he is probably better known to people as the man behind many TV specials on African-American history and genealogy and... He's a really wonderful, great guy and a super scholar.
I love your story about how you discovered one of the oldest manuscripts.
Oh, that's I know the one you're talking about. That was actually what that was. I was putting together the first sale. This is 1995. And believe me, it was difficult. I had the great idea, but I had to scuffle to find the material for the sale. Over the years, I'd met a great many collectors and dealers and so forth, and so I called in a lot of favors and talked to people. And so Swan put out plenty of publicity to attract consigners for that first auction. And one of the folks, it was a family that responded, were some people from Richmond, Virginia, and they were white, and they're ancestor was the captain of a revenue cutter. Now, the revenue cutters were the the ships that patrolled the west coast of Africa after the British put an end to ban on the slave trade. They put a ban on the slave trade in 1807, and to back it up, they sent their navy out along the coast of West Africa to seize any ships that they suspected were involved in the slave trade. And so what the family had were some logbooks from that captain of that ship, their ancestor, and some papers of his, and they were going to donate some of them to a university, and they also gave, they consigned some of his papers to me. But while we were talking, they said, well, you know, you might be interested in these folks up in Providence, used to be neighbors of us down here in Richmond, but the mother-in-law, who was getting on, she was in her early 90s at that point, claimed that she had a manuscript written by a slave. And so the little light bulb went off on top of my head. And so I got the name and number of these people. I called them up, and sure enough, the grandma had, her father was a well-known stamp collector, and he had at an auction, on a whim, I guess, bought a manuscript that was written by a slave in North Carolina in his native written tongue. You know, there isn't a written tongue in Africa, which is Arabic. And so what they had was his own story written in 1831 in North Carolina, and his name was Omar Ibn Said. And he was also an imam. He was a teacher of Islam. And so when I got to visit with the people and sit down with them, everything was in a box, and it was not only that manuscript, which was fantastic, but there were two translations of it that had been done by missionaries, and there was also some correspondence that this Omar had with another, by the way, Omar was from Senegal. He was a Fula tribesman from Senegal. And he, when he was captured and brought to the United States, he immediately tried to escape, and he was caught and put in the jail in Chapel Hill in North Carolina. And he got a stone or something, and he wrote a whole bunch of stuff on the wall in Arabic, and that caught the attention of the brother of the governor at the time, who then said he must have him, and he bought him. He bought him, and then he gave him paper and pen, and he allowed him to not work in the fields. And it didn't turn him loose, but he allowed him to work and write and so forth. And he got in, his owner got in contact with a man by the name of Theodore Weld, who was, Theodore Dwight.
Harrison?
Theodore
Harrison.
Dwight, who was an abolitionist. And he was able to put Omar in touch with other Fula Senegalese who were in a position to be able to write to him, and they communicated. This manuscript is the only known slave manuscript written by an African slave in his native tongue, in Arabic. That's in his native written tongue.
Where is this located right now? Where is this manuscript?
It is in private hands, but it's probably going to wind up in the Emirates. It's been translated. It's been on exhibit at the United Nations. It's been around the world, and it's available in print. I'm sorry, I can't give you a publisher right now, but if people will Google Omar, Omar Ibn, Ibn, Said, Said, and you will find a lot. It will get a lot of hits on that. So that was actually, to move along, that was the first big find that I was able to bring to light. which was a vindication. It was, you know, everything that I wanted to have happen with a sale like this, that I wanted material that had been forgotten about, lost, or whatever, to come forth and to help us piece back together this tremendous history.
Now, before we move on to Swan Gallery's latest collection and auction, let's talk about your experience with the Antique Roadshow. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, I was on the Antique Roadshow for 4 years, it was not a great experience. They asked me to come on the show to appraise, you know, to be the equivalent of any of the other type, you know, furniture people than the you know, painting, poster people, and whatever. But every time that I would get something that was really serious, something that dealt with a serious subject rather than a cookie jar or something like that, we'd film it, and then they'd kill the story. And after 4 years of that, I just said goodbye because it seemed to me that they didn't really want to dig into the history. They wanted pleasant stories. And a lot of the early history is certainly unpleasant.
That's it.
I really don't want to dump on the roadshow. It's a great show. They, you know, it's just that they weren't ready to discuss slavery and prejudice also, because there was also we were in Oklahoma, and there was many people. Well, there may be people who don't know that about Greenwood and the riots of 1921, where the black community called Black Wall Street in Oklahoma and Tulsa was destroyed. But not just destroyed, it looked like Hiroshima after the people got through with it. When that happened, there was a series of postcards that were real photograph postcards were made. There was, probably about 15, 12 or 15 in the series. And a couple of books have been written about that riot. And I had hoped when we went out to do that show in Oklahoma that perhaps one of those postcards or a couple would show up. And to my amazement, the entire set showed up. This family had an entire set, and so we did the on-camera thing and did the whole thing. And it's not a pretty story. It's a story like many of the riots that took place from about 1918 or 19 through about 1922. 1919, by the way, is called Red Summer. There were no less than two dozen major riots in America at that time. It was really very, very bloody, very awful, but part of the history. And so we did the whole shot. And at the last minute, they decided again not to run it. So that was that. But as I say, I really, you know, that was
that was an excellent synopsis of what happened. And you know, it was very educational. You talked about Oklahoma and the Red Summer. So I thank you for sharing this story. Now, we have a call on the line, and he's waiting to hear about you talk about the upcoming auction.
Oh, sure.
And the Marcus Garvey image. Can you talk about that?
Well, the upcoming, probably what got this person's attention was what I had in the last sale, but I do have a bunch of Garvey material coming up in this sale, but what I had in the last sale in March was a pen drawing of Marcus Garvey by a French artist. And it's interesting, this French artist had an idea to do these pen drawings of what he considered these geniuses of the time. And he sent these drawings of these people sent them the originals and asked them to write something underneath it, write something about themselves. And he sent them to Marcus Garvey, he sent them to Sigmund Freud, he sent them to, I believe, Nikola Tesla, or one of the great inventors, Thomas Edison or something, but all these people. I happened to come upon the Garvey one, and I was just astonished. I mean, Garvey wrote exactly what his philosophy was and how he felt that many nations had risen up and had become great and had their moment because of the people within their nation or their empire or whatever felt the need, their pride, and the ability. And he said that it was now the black man's time. It was a tremendous, tremendous quote. Probably the most important Garvey item that I'd had to date. Coming up in the next auction, I have a flyer, a handbill for, I guess we'd call it a broadside, something that you'd paste up on a wall to let people know about something. And this is a broadside advertising the earliest meeting in North America, a meeting and speech to be given by Marcus Garvey in 1917. That's very, very, very early. And that's coming up. There's another broadside for another meeting that took place right after he was arrested. A photo, a silver print photo of him. There's going to be, let me think, what else? A couple of stock certificates signed by him.
Could you talk about the stock certificates?
Well, the stock certificates, there are a couple of different kinds. There's actually several. There's the Black Star Line, which is the one that got him in trouble. The Black Star Line was a shipping line that Garvey conceived of that would take African Americans to Africa, and if that's where they wanted to emigrate, and also to deal with Liberia, and take African products from Liberia, bring them to the United States, and ship products made by African Americans back to Africa, and so forth, to establish basically this trade, back and forth trade. They had the Black Star Line and Garvey, the UNIA, that's the Universal Negro Improvement Association. They had one ship already, and they were trying to get funds for another ship. Pardon me while I have a swallow of water. They were trying to get funds together for another ship to be called the Phyllis Wheatley. And they didn't own the ship yet. They were trying to get the funds together. And unfortunately, the Garvey's publicity department, the people who would send out letters soliciting funds, sent out a solicitation that had a picture of the ship that they wanted to acquire, and they'd airbrushed the name Phyllis Wheatley onto the bow of the ship. It was actually called the General Gottels or something like that. And so they airbrushed this name on Phyllis Wheatley, and the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, got him on a technicality. The technicality being they didn't own the ship as yet. And so they got him on mail fraud. And the judge, of course, threw the book at him. I mean, for mail fraud, that would normally be probably, depending on the gravity of it, but probably no more than a year in prison. In this case, I think the sentence was something like 10 years and hard labor, and they send them to the prison in Atlanta, Georgia. In any case, there was such a reaction to all of that with white and black folks that he was freed, and the deal was that he had to leave. He was deported, had to leave the country. And that kind of took the steam out of the movement, that and something else, which really offended black community, which was that Garvey had sat down with the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan with a kind of let's make friends proposal, both of whom sought separatism. And that really, really offended a great many people. And I truly believe that if Garvey had been an African-American and not a West Indian, that never would have happened, because someone in his family somewhere would probably have had a brush with the Klan, and so that just wouldn't have happened. But the combination of his being arrested and that kind of really put an end to the movement here. He wound up in London, and the UNIA, by the way, is still alive and going in London. There's still a small, solid group of people there and in England in general that keep the idea alive.
Well, I'd just like to make a comment. We had Malcolm X's daughter on last Thursday night, Ilyasa Sadat, and she
mm-hmm.
mentioned that her grandfather, Malcolm X's father and mother, worked for the UNIA.
My father-in-law's father came up here from North Carolina. He was about to be lynched, and he got out of there and came up here.
Well, she said that her grandparents helped defend Marcus Garvey throughout that case.
Mm-hmm.
That she was mentioned. So I just thought that was interesting.
Oh,
so we have a caller on the line, and
okay.
He mentioned that he wanted to call in earlier, and I said, of course, you can call in.
Okay, well,
here.
Fire away.
My computer is so slow. Let's see if he's on here. Paula, are you on the line?
I'm here. Wyatt's here.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello. Hi.
Hello.
Hi. You're on the line with Mr. Wyatt Houston Day from Swan Galleries. Do you have a question about Marcus Garvey or a comment?
Yeah, you talking to me?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay. I thought I had to press a button. I'm sorry. Yeah, I actually did have a question about the finding. You mentioned you had a couple broadsides. What city were those?
One is from actually from Asbury Park in New Jersey, and the other is from Atlanta.
And what year were they?
Well, the one from Atlanta is from 1917. And as far as I can find from Robert Hill's huge, I think it's up to 10 volumes now. I've got 9 of them. I believe it's the earliest mass meeting that he spoke at. And the second one in Asbury Park is 1924.
Oh, okay.
Is that all?
So,
yeah, those fabulous collectibles there.
Yeah, they'll be in the catalog. That catalog ought to be available in January. We usually have that sale the third week or so of February. So I'd say that I'm hopeful that I'll have it written and ready to go by, let's say, a month, 5 weeks before the sale. And this year's catalog, by the way, sold out. I've had people trying to get copies of it, so I'm going to have them print more copies this year. A lot of people, you don't have to participate in the sale. A lot of people just like to have the catalog. I hope not being immodest, but it is really an interesting catalog. There's always a lot of wonderful stuff in it. I mean, really unusual things. If this sale has done nothing else, at least, I mean, I will go to my grave feeling good about the fact that this sale has brought forth an awful lot of history that was potentially lost.
That's right. Absolutely. I'm a UNIA historian for the association, and I'm one who not only administrates the Millions for Marcus Garvey site, where I found some of the information, but I'm one who interviews a lot of elders in their hundreds and 90s and 80s, et cetera, who were born
wow.
and raised. And you'd be surprised after some of them pass. I try as much as possible to ask them to either release or preserve some kind of way what they have, and
well, listen,
you know, entrust, you know, it to those, you know, people who will preserve it after they pass. But oftentimes, a lot of these elders who have the very rare and precious photos, recordings, all sorts of things, the minute they pass away, is thrown in the trash can.
Isn't it a shame? It's a shame. Listen, when we're off the air, ask Leslie for my telephone number. Give me a call.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I will.
Right.
I appreciate it.
And I'll do that. And Facebook me right now, please.
Oh, okay. I'm actually
all
on
right.
the road now. So I had to call in.
All right. When you get a chance, just Facebook me, and I'll put everything out there right on Facebook.
Okay, beautiful. Okay, I appreciate
Thank
that.
Thank you. And give me your full name, sir.
Yes, it's Moriyama Kamau. And
I'll write that down myself.
Can you spell it for Mr. Day?
Sure. Mwariama. Moriyama. And last
Moriyama.
Name. Yeah, it's a Gikuyu name from East Africa. I adopted.
Uh-huh.
And Kamau is Kamau.
All right. I've written
all right.
down here.
We'll all be in touch with one another off air.
Great.
But thank you for calling, and that's some great information. We have to have you on the show as well.
Oh, I always love to. But thank you. I'm in the show.
Okay, thank you.
All right, take care.
Okay, Wyatt, what else is next that you'd like to talk about?
Let's see. Let's talk about the sale a little bit, what's coming up. I've gotten about 150 lots out of what I think is going to be about 500 lots cataloged already. One of the things that I think is really super is a big broadside. I mean, this thing is big. It's about almost 40 inches high by about 29 inches wide, and it is a broadside of the officers of the 3rd North Carolina U.S. Volunteer Infantry for the Spanish-American War. Now, these are all black officers, and they're led by Colonel James H. Young and Major A.J. Haywood and Major A.J. Walker. Now, these are people that more people ought to know about. This is an entire unit of African American officers and soldiers under them from North Carolina. This is a very, very rare broadside. It's an engraving. There are portraits of every one of these officers. And then there are what we call a vignette, which means a small scene, a vignette engraving of the soldiers in battle and the soldiers in their camp. This is an incredible item and very, very, very knocked
Can
out
you tell
to have
the story?
It.
Can you tell the story of how you received it, how it
Well, these things, this one happened to be mine. I bought this privately. But most of this material is consigned by individuals. You know, people know about the sale now, and they call me or they write or email me, and that's how these things come in. There's a lot of pardon me, I'm a little bit hoarse. There's a lot of material that's going to be in the sale that is. Relative to, of course, the earliest histories, you know, history which is slavery and abolition. There's some very, very interesting early documents, some of them from the colonial New York, that mention some of the earliest settlers in what we call Brooklyn today, but it was called Long Island back then. And let me see, I'm trying to think of other things.
I wanted to ask you a quick question about the military pictures.
Mm-hmm.
You sent me some images which I used to make a slideshow.
Oh, okay. Well,
the
images
that
you got are all from this last sale, from the sale in March. All of the images that you got were things from this just this last sale. And if you tell me what they are, I can talk about them.
Okay. Before we talk about them, I want you to finish where you left off. That is talking about the abolitionists.
Okay. Well, actually, I thought of something because there's a time element here. I wanted to talk about what I'm doing with this sale is there's going to be a very large section on civil rights, and it includes, this is really fantastic, it includes the original vote as it was taken on the floor of the Senate with the yeas and nays of which senator voted for and which senator voted against the 1964 Civil Rights Act. It was presented to Clarence Mitchell, who was the bureau head on Washington, D.C., NAACP, and he was the NAACP lobbyist in Washington for years and years and years. Clarence Mitchell fought to get a civil rights bill put through. And it finally, of course, as everyone should know, it was put through under Lyndon Johnson's administration. It was something, by the way, that was started by Jack Kennedy and finished by Johnson. And a brave thing for Johnson to do, by the way, being a Southerner, being a Texan, he knew that doing that would end his career. Really, with the Dixiecrats, they just dumped him after that. But this is the original bill as the vote. What it looks like is two big pages, long pages, with the name of the senator and the state they come from, and an ink mark in the yes side and an ink mark in the no side, depending on who voted for what. Well, of course, someone like Strom Thurmond from South Carolina, we know just how he was going to vote, and Barry Goldwater from Arizona, and so on. And it's a very, very, I mean, this is something equivalent to, if you think about it, the 13th Amendment or 14th Amendment. I mean, this is a major, major thing. Not only is there the vote, the tally, as it was called, the tally as it was taken on the floor of the Senate, there is also the actual Civil Rights Act, the Civil Rights Bill, as it was in its last moments with corrections on it, ink corrections, by Emanuel Seller, who was the senator who was one of the people who crafted the bill, who actually put the legal language together on it. And that, again, is with a big, long presentation to Clarence Mitchell. There is some fantastic material having to do with the early NAACP. There is an archive of papers having to do with, as I mentioned earlier, the Red Summer of 1919, mm-hmm. Which is quite incredible. There are letters from James Weldon Johnson, from Walter White, from Mooresville Story, from all the early people in NAACP who I think I should explain. The biggest riot, there were three major riots in that year, and God knows how many in other cities, but Chicago and Knoxville, Tennessee, and Elaine, Arkansas were really bloody. They wound up with gun battles. This was really, really, in many cities, people were just beaten up and so forth, their houses burned and businesses trashed and so forth. But in Chicago and in Elaine, Arkansas, and in Knoxville, people fought back. And of course, the law arrested them. And the NAACP came to their rescue, and they provided legal counsel. And a lot of the papers in this little archive deal with their defense and are very specific. There's, in this archive is also the coroner's report from Chicago on the deaths of the people in the riot. It is an incredible prime resource for scholars to study. And that comes from the Mitchell family.
Now,
by the way, I should mention the Mitchell family. The Clarence Mitchell married Juanita Jackson. Juanita Jackson was a major figure in the NAACP. But her mom, Lily M. Jackson, was called Ma Jackson. She's called the mother of the NAACP, and she is from Baltimore. And it was Lily M. Jackson that desegregated Ford's Theater in Baltimore. Ford's Theater not only wouldn't have black actors on the stage, they wouldn't let a black person into the theater. And she fought and fought from about 1948. There were pickets ongoing through 1952. They finally integrated that theater. So then there are things about all of that in this upcoming sale.
Wonderful. Now, I'm looking at the slideshow, the Aetna Life Insurance.
Okay, that's very rare. I'm trying to find it in my book here. Do we have a lot number on it?
Oh, I don't have it. It's probably
here it is. I have it. I got it. That's very rare. We know for a fact that people insured their slaves. It's just that these documents, for the most part, didn't survive. They're oddly enough, there are potentially hundreds of thousands of slave sale documents. Because if you pause for a moment and think that at the time of the Emancipation Proclamation, there were 4 million or more people in bondage, and then you have to consider a free population as well. But 4 million people, all of whom had to have been sold at least one time. And every time a slave was sold, no matter how informal that transaction might have been between two farmers or something, it still had to be done with the notary and the judge. And three documents are generated for every sale, one for the court, one for the buyer, one for the seller. So if you think 4 million people been sold one time, 4 million times 3, okay, we've got 12 million documents. That doesn't count tax papers and so forth. So there are tons of slave sale documents out there. But oddly enough, things like an insurance policy and more detailed legal documents are very hard to find. And it's not that we learn too much from these things, but they remind us. They're part of the story, and these are things that if you're going to have an exhibit in a museum that has slave sale documents and so forth, you need to show the whole story. And so it's glad that we had this one. And by the way, the only the second one that I've seen in 16 years of sales, going into the 17th.
And what do you, if it's not a tacky question, do you expect to get out of it? How much?
Well, no, it's not a matter of expect. This was in the sale in March, and I'll tell you exactly. I put an estimate on it because I hadn't, if you have something you've had many times before, you can put an educated guess on it. On this one, I put $700 to $1,000 as an estimate. It opened up at $900, and it sold for
$3,200. Wow.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought it was very valuable. I've heard about
very,
it.
Very, very rare.
But I've never saw any documents. You also have something about the Apollo here, the Apollo Theater.
Okay, in the music section, let me see what we're talking about. Oh, hang on. Music. Let's see.
Apollo Theater in Harlem.
That's good.
There's some people on it. Looks like a playbill when you're dancing.
Yeah, I'm just going there. It's in the music section, so I've got to get there. All right, let me see. There's, what did she send you? There's the,
we also
there's
have
the there, I know the one here. Are you talking about the nightclub map of Harlem?
Yes.
Okay, that's, that's not just the Apollo. That is a that was a thing. It's called the Nightclub Map of Harlem, and it appeared in a magazine called the Manhattan Magazine in 1933. And it was drawn by, the original drawing for it was by Sims Campbell, a black cartoonist and artist. Campbell was the guy that did the cheesecake drawings for Esquire magazine. Most people, I would venture to say nearly everybody, did not know that this was a black guy that was doing these wonderful, sexy models that appeared in Esquire magazine all through the 1930s. And it was E. Sims Campbell. And he did this big map of Harlem. And it took in all the clubs, like Small's Paradise, the Cotton Club, and the Radium Club. I mean, there was, at one time, Harlem was just really hopping. I mean, there was all kind of jazz clubs and nightclubs. So that was something that, again, we had not seen, okay? Nobody had seen. I talked to a friend just yesterday who, after 20 years, he's a collector, after 20 years, he finally found one. And he said he was so surprised to see the one in my sale, and I had never even heard of it, let alone seen it. So I put an estimate of $600 to $800. It opened at $1,000, and it sold for
$14,000. $14,000?
That's right. And it was bought by, I can't say exactly who, but a man who owns a major nightclub.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow, that's awesome. Now, the sword.
Hmm?
The sword. I have an image of a sword.
The sword. Okay, now the sword... is really very interesting. That belonged to a black officer, a top sergeant, during the Civil War. Now, the highest rank that any African-American could make in the Civil War was top sergeant. And he was, we had all of his information. His name was David Spears, and he was from Massachusetts. And he had, he was from Ohio. He joined the Massachusetts Volunteer Infantry. And he served. He was wounded at the Battle of Honey Hill. I wrote an awful lot on this guy. He served under Robert Gould Shaw. In any case, I made a mistake. I was talking about Robert Gould Shaw led the 55th. He was with the... led the 54th. He was with the 55th. We never see things like this. I mean, usually people keep them in the family. I mean, you would think that this found its way to a collector who then consigned it to me. And the sword is engraved with David Spears' name on the side of it. Really quite amazing. It came with a bunch of stuff, too. It wasn't just the sword. It came with his medals, and a lot of other things. It's quite wonderful. And that went to the museum in Washington, to the new Black Museum.
Okay, and then we have a picture of Frederick Douglass.
Yeah, that is a... let me just go through my catalog here. That is an image of Frederick Douglass that was... hitherto unknown. No one had seen this before, and kind of took a guess from the look of him, from how much gray was in his hair and so forth. We guessed it probably Civil War time, the 1860s, and that was estimated at $3,500 to $5,000, and it sold for $6,000.
Now, are you finding that your items are increasing in value?
Oh, this material, all historical material, black or white, is increasing as time goes on, because you just have to look at it as supply and demand. There's more interest, especially when you look at all of the African-American historical material. There's more and more interest in the material and a limited quantity of it. But some of these things, for instance, I've had many photographs of Frederick Douglass over the years, many, many photographs. And so my estimate was really pretty close on, like 3,500 to 5, it went for 6. But there were certain things that, there are certain things that one can only guess at. And very often they go way above. I mean, for instance, I had a banner in that sale, a wonderful big banner. I mean, it was 54 inches by 54 inches. And it was a banner from Father Divine. I don't know how many people out there listening know who he was, but he was a major, major evangelical figure. And he had a big following, black and white. And this was in the late 1930s, 40s, and even into the 50s. And I remember when I was a little boy, we lived in Washington Heights, and I remember his angels, they called them, they were dressed in dark clothing like nuns, would come around to the neighborhood collecting money for the cause. Anyway, this wonderful banner is like purple, and it was like quilted. There's a picture of a dove over the a globe of the world, and it says righteousness, God, and peace, justice, and truth. And I'd estimated it $750 to $1,000. These things are kind of quirky. You never know a religious thing, how much interest there's going to be or whatever. That sold for $30,000. I mean, that stunned everybody. And that meant that there were a bunch of folks. See, things don't get up in an auction. Things don't get up to huge prices unless you've got a number of people bidding. And so there was that much interest in that thing that were just took off like a rocket.
So there was finding more people are coming to your auctions or less?
You know, not only that. I mean, the room is usually full. The room is never has it not been full. We've had blizzards and people have shown up. But we also have people calling us from everywhere in the world. We have people calling from France and England and Germany on the telephones. We've got people online bidding.
All right. Now, I have a lot 141 here.
Let me see. 141.
It's in the middle of it, looks like a poster. In the middle of it, it says, on Monday evening, February 2nd.
Okay, that is a poster. It was on a stencil on a, like, if you know what composite board is, the kind of stuff that's like pressed board. And it was done for a show that was going to open at the Apollo called Harlem, a thrilling play of the Black Belt. And that play was written by a very famous black writer, Wallace Thurman. And the artwork was done by a tremendously famous African-American artist, Aaron Douglas. And this is something that, I mean, it's really beautiful. I don't know if everyone can see this. I hope so. It's really beautiful. And I put an estimate on it of $7,500 to $10,000, and it sold for $15,000. It's just incredible. One of a kind. It was a stencil, the kind of thing where you cut out a larger piece of cardboard or whatever the design you want, and then you paint over it or spray paint or however you get the paint on. Just incredible. Aaron Douglas is probably the best known artist of the Harlem Renaissance. The 1920s. His artwork is very, very Art Deco style. Very, very much. He uses a lot of silhouette, and it's just very unique.
Okay. The last question. Last question I have tonight, because we're up to the hour, is Lot 492. Another poster.
492.
Gulliver in the middle. Othello.
Hang on a second. Oh, okay. What that is, That is a poster for a performance of a very, very famous black actor by the name of Ira Aldridge. Ira Aldridge defied all the rules of the 19th century, where a black actor performing in Shakespeare was just something so amazing. But he was recognized, of course, as often these things were. He was recognized in England and in Russia before he was given any kind of credit here. As a matter of fact, he retired in Russia and lived in Russia till his passing. And this is a very, very rare poster for a performance of Ira Aldridge in Othello. And that's something, by the way, that that most people might should know, that in the 20th century that Paul Robeson starred in. And so,
right.
As a matter of fact, that's how his big start in theater was, in Othello in London also, by the way.
And lot number 6 is a picture, looks like, of Afghans being assaulted.
Okay, well, that there's 6 and 7 are two huge what are called mezzotints, and the mezzotint is a type of engraving, and these are two very big engravings. One shows an African being taken by slavers while his family is cringing. You can see them in the background, the mother with the child, and the slavers are taking the man away. And that's called The Slave Trade. It was a very, very famous painting. And then the artist, Mr. Moreland, George Moreland, made an engraving from it. And these versions of this engraving were sold to raise funds for the Anti-Slavery Society in London. The English were actually in the vanguard of the anti-slavery movement, far more so than the Americans were. In many ways, it was easier for English people to be anti-slavery. They did not have plantations on their land. The English plantations were in the West Indies. And so, in a sense, it was easier for them to be against something they didn't have on their doorstep. And though belittle the movement in America was very strong, but the British were the first to abolish the slave trade in 1807, and then to actually put that, put their money where their mouths were, as I said earlier when we first started talking, where they put these revenue cutters patrolling the coast of Africa. And they were the first to abolish slavery, to emancipate their slaves in 1834, nearly 30 years before we did. So these two are very famous images.
We also have lot number 8. Looks like a stone.
Okay, lot number 8 is what is called a ballast stone. This is probably the most interesting thing that was in the sale. When ships went to sea, really right up until the 19th century and the 20th century, early part, they would need ballast. If there were cargo ships and they had a bunch of cargo, tons and tons in their hold, they were stable in the water. If there was a rough seas or a storm, the ship would sit in the water and it was pretty stable. But once they dumped their cargo wherever they were going and the hold was empty, that ship could get bounced around like a cork in a storm. So they took on what they call ballast. And ballast was often in the form of round stones. They weigh about 15 pounds on average. And there was a kind of stone that was often taken on ships in England that came out of the rivers in England, and they were round and kind of smooth stones like this. This stone was found in a 16th century wreck off the Bahamas. Some divers by the head of the group, the ship that was doing the dive, this was in 1992, Herbert Humphreys was a very famous diver. He dives for treasure most of the time. And they were diving for a treasure from a Spanish ship when they found this ship. And there was this stone, and it was in the hold. And as near as we can guess, as I could guess, is that a slave, because we know it was a slave ship, where there was shackles were found and so forth, that one of the slaves carved with the edge of his shackles or something, because that would be the only metal he had, carved this design on the stone. This design is the same design that is seen on elephant masks from Africa, from the Guru people, who are the people who would be in today's Ivory Coast. And this is a fantastic item. I mean, it's really the idea.
How did you guys get it?
Huh?
How did you
get
it?
Well, actually, it came to me from the man who got it from the dive itself. And he is giving me a tusk, an elephant tusk, that was also taken out of that dive for the sale coming up in February. I will have an elephant tusk that was found in the hold of that ship as well.
And the ship is a slave ship?
The ship was an English slave ship, and we know really pretty much when it sank, between 1570 and 1575.
Okay. We only have like two more images. Honor King and...
Okay, that's...
Great
Honor
Israel.
King is a placard that was carried... By the sanitation workers in Memphis the week that Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. He went down to Memphis to support the sanitation workers in their strike, and that was in April. And the placards were made by the union. The sanitation workers union was an ACME union. They made these posters up. One of them read, "I am a man." The other one read, "Honor King and Racism." And I'm trying to think of the third one. There were three in all that were made. And they're very, very rare because the most of them were destroyed. A lot of them got destroyed in a kind of riot. People set on these marchers, and there was a confrontation, and as you know, just days later, Dr. King was shot. So the first posters that were carried read, "I am a man," and I have that poster for this next sale. And a lot of your listeners out there probably know about that sign. It's emblematic. It's an icon of the civil rights movement and of Dr. King.
I had a gentleman that is a coin collector on.
I'm sorry?
6 months ago. I had a coin collector on my show,
mm-hmm.
and he had a wooden coin from England with... a man kneeling, an African.
Yeah, and it says,
slave.
"Am I not a man and a brother?"
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Can you tie those two together?
Well, I think that's the beauty of it. I don't know whether they did it when the people at the Memphis, the Sanitation Workers Union, when they created the sign that said, "I am a man," I don't know if they were thinking of that in particular, but to me, it was absolutely like a perfect circle, like the original slogan and the image of the kneeling slave. It's a kneeling slave, and actually there was an American version of that which showed a kneeling woman, and it said, "Am I not a woman and a sister?" And that was created by an African-American engraver by the name of Patrick Reason. And so, yeah, that's
full circle.
Hmm?
Full circle. You are right. I agree with you that you said that this is like full circle. The two would be so similar.
Well, if one of them asks the question, the other one answers it, doesn't it? Am I not a brother, a man and a brother? And it says, I am a man. It says, absolutely. There's a very famous photograph.
We have Lot 161, a statue.
One second. 161. I'll get there in a second. 161. Okay, that's that's a bronze statue, really beautiful statue that was done by a Belgian artist by the name of Arsène Maton. And he lived for a time about between 1900 and 1910 in the Belgian Congo. And he was very taken with the Congolese people, and he made many, many statues of them. And this is a statue of an African mother and holding her child. And it was about 12 inches high and made, as I say, between 1900 and 1910. And I had estimated that at $3,000 to $4,000, it sold for $2,800. That was a great bargain, by the way, because I had looked up records for his artwork and they sold for $5,000, $6,000, $10,000. So somebody got themselves a very nice statue at a very nice price.
Okay.
And there were
go ahead.
I was going to say there were a lot of very, very rare panther things that were in the sale that brought some pretty high prices, too. There was a... I'm trying to find it here. Yeah, there was a poster by Emery, who was the cultural minister for the Black Panthers out in Oakland. And it said, free Bobby, free Erica, free Rochelle McGee, free Angela, free Kathleen. And that was Lot 190. And I had, that was an original print by Emery, not just a poster. And that I had estimated at $1,500. That was a big surprise. That sold for
$7,000. Wow.
So there was a lot of interest in panther material. Years ago, I gave a lecture out at Wayne State in Detroit, and it was a lecture on, it was a talk, really, on collecting. And people asked me, and have asked me for many years, well, you know, what I want to start collecting, what should I collect? Well, first of all, my first advice to that is collect what you love. Don't collect as an investment. That's a bad idea. I know people think that it's a good idea to invest as an investment. And if you know what you're doing, it can be. But if you're going to collect, you should collect something you love. You should collect things that move you. And, you know, that's easier said than done for a lot of people because of you know, the pocketbook is how much money somebody can spend, especially collecting, where you figure you might treat yourself to something every month or so. And so my advice to people, and this was back in 2003, was collect the modern movements, collect the civil rights movement, collect the Panthers, and because those things were around. You could buy posters and booklets and things for very little back, you know, in 2000 to 2003, and even up till 2005 or so, things were still kind of lurking in the low end in terms of price. This past sale, set records. I had a Panther poster of Huey Newton, which everybody probably knows, where Huey's sitting in the big rattan chair holding a spear in one hand and a rifle in the other. And I've sold that again and again at different sales and personally sold it, because I am a dealer, for anywhere between $1,500 and $2,200, depending on the condition of it. It's a big poster. It's like 35 inches or so by 24 inches big. And so I estimated this one at $1,500 to $2,500. It sold for $16,000. So that tells you that there's a lot of new interest in this material. Now, whether they'll ever bring that price again, I don't know. But it took two or three people to get it up there. And out of those three didn't get it. So the next one I put up there might bring, I don't think it'll get up to 16, but might bring 6,000 or 7,000.
Now, we're about to close the show, and I would like you to end the show by giving your information as far as your company and then the Swan Gallery's information. And I know you're looking for people to sign
Swan,
them, right?
Swan Galleries, repeat for everybody, I'm the head of the African-American department at Swan, and there is another department there that is the African-American Fine Art Department, and that grew out of my department. I used to include a lot of art by Romare Bearden and Hale Woodruff and Jacob Lawrence and so forth, and it just grew and grew and grew, and finally we decided to have a whole different department and just have sales of fine art, and that's been a tremendous success. But where was I when I said so? Anyway, I'm the head of the African American department there, not to be confused with the fine art. So if people are going to call and offer things to fine art, you want to talk to somebody named Nigel Freeman. But otherwise, for everything else, you talk to me. And Swan's number is 212-254-4710. And the catalogs are always available in January. They're usually $35. And hope see a lot of people there who may be for the first time. By the way, there's no admission to an event like this, but there's a preview for this sale every year. 1 week before the sale, all of the material is on exhibit, and anybody at all can come. And I urge people to come and bring your kids, because this is a chance to see material that is going to, a lot of, half of it winds up in museums. So this is the kind of material that, you know, you get an opportunity to see everything from represented from the earliest slave trade and abolitionist movement and the Civil War and Reconstruction and so forth through the present day to the Panthers. So I advise people, do bring your children. They're often, during these previews, people come with their kids, and I'm happy to take them around and explain things. So, and I welcome everybody, by the way, to come to these previews.
Now, do you recommend a field trip, a high school field trip?
Sure. I mean, if people want to arrange to bring a group of children, or, you know, of high school or middle or whatever to the gallery, just call up during the preview time. You just find, usually the preview, as I say, is about 1 week before the sale, and just call up and let me know. And I'll make a time so that I can devote my time to showing everybody around.
Excellent. Well, Wyatt, I had a wonderful time. I learned a great deal about African-American history, and it's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Leslie. I enjoy these. I enjoy these talks very much myself.
Okay, and you get better. I know that you're not feeling 100% tonight. But I thank you again, and we have to do this more often.
Yes, indeed. We will. We must.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Take care now. Good night, everybody. Bye-bye.